Radio.
Where does Pope Francis's treasure lie? A talk by Father Jack McLean at Evenings with Pope Francis.
A little truth in, full disclosure, I'm not Pope Francis. He will not, in fact, be here this evening. And I can, however, tell you the extent of my interaction with him, which was this. He went by at about 40 miles an hour at World Youth Day. That's as close as I've been to him. He waved, or I waved. I don't think he saw me. So what do I have to say about him? And I'm talking about the topic I was given that I chose was, where's my treasure? I want to kind of talk a little bit about, where does he think his treasure is? What does that mean for us? And why does he think that way? Why does he think the way he does? Now, that's someplace I may actually have something to offer. Because of the Jesuit thing, whatever that is, we are an incredibly diverse group, all right? Any issue you can name, you will likely find two Jesuits on opposite sides of it, usually screaming at each other at full volume, and arguing very convincingly for whatever their point of view is, all right? So we are an incredibly diverse group of men. But there are certain things that kind of hold us together, or that you could say are characteristic. And I think a lot of those are coming through in the speech, in the action, in the thought, and in the heart of the Pope, okay? So I want to talk a little bit about that. Does anybody see, he recently did his first big English language interview, and America Magazine ran it in the States, which is the Jesuit Weekly Catholic publication, shameless plug. They ran it, and it's a, you know, it's an interesting interview. There's a lot to cover in there. I'm a little fascinated by the fascination that the media and that people have with him. You know, I already saw an article called Decoding Pope Francis. I'm like, wow, you know, we have to decode this guy? I think he's shooting pretty straight, you know, really. But I think there's a lot in what he is saying. I'll give you that. But if anybody saw that interview, there is one of the things he was asked about, who are you? Who are you? And, you know, the interviewer responded with, you know, he said he took a deep pause, he kind of thought, and he said, I'm a sinner. Now, I think that's really indicative. That's one of the things that we could point to and say, that's a very Jesuit thing. For one thing, in about 1982, 84, someplace in there, the then general of the society, the top Jesuit in the world, was a guy by the name of Peter Hans Kolvenbach. And he was asked, what does it mean to be a Jesuit? And Father Kolvenbach responded, it is to be a sinner, but to know that one is saved. Now, there's an interesting echo for you. Why is that important? Look, I think Catholics, we do a great job of sort of beating ourselves up all the time with, yeah, I know I'm a sinner, okay? And depending on what culture you're from, you can be really good at that. Irish. okay, if that's where the train stops, then I think you got an issue. You know, are we all sinners? Yes, we are all sinners. But if that's the end of the story, that's pretty grim, and that's not what Jesus came for. Okay, so where does that come from? Where does that importance? The spiritual exercises, I'm going to talk a fair bit this evening about the exercises. The exercises come out of the experience of St. Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the Jesuits. And they really started it as his sort of personal journal that he kept over a period of years. And then he started refining it. And he started giving these exercises to other people. And the form that it has taken is a 30-day silent directed retreat. That's the traditional form. Well, at the very beginning of that, there's a sort of precursor that's called the first principle and foundation. All right, it's an annotation before Ignatius has you starting the exercises. And the first principle and foundation is this, that human beings are created to know, love, and serve God. And the second half of it is, and everything in creation is designed to get us to that end. Okay? Now, our job then is to figure out what gets us closer to God. What's all this mean? If you think about it this way, if all of creation, if everybody we meet, if everything we love doing, if all of that is some sort of giant Rube Goldberg machine that's been put here just for us with one purpose in mind, to draw us closer to God, that's a pretty impressive little thought, okay? It's not good enough. Ignatius is going to say that you and I are smart enough to know the difference between good and bad, right and wrong. Our choice is to always choose the better, what he calls the magis. If you hang around Jesuits for any length of time, you're going to hear that really quickly. Okay? The magis. And it's about, maybe being the CEO of Microsoft gets me closer to God. Maybe that if I do that, there are a lot of things I can do, and I can somehow be led closer to God doing that. But maybe there's something else that, if that leads me, that could lead me close to God. Is there something else that leads me closer to God? And that's what Ignatius, that's what that first principle and foundation is. Our entire job, the whole project of our lives, is to try to figure out not what gets us to God, but what gets us closer to God. So the first principle is that sort of precursor. And from there, the exercises go into the first week. And the first week is about knowing ourselves and being honest about ourselves and being honest about what we can and cannot do. Okay? So that's where this talk about, I think that's where he's coming from. I think that has a real influence on his view about people and about himself. I'm a sinner. I am desperately in need of God's saving grace. I am a good person, though. That's the other thing. I'll come back to that in a second, too. But I think that's sort of one of the things that we're hearing from him. That's one of the things that's important and influencing what he's saying. That's influenced by the Jesuit worldview, too, that first principle and foundation. You know, a presupposition of that is that creation is good, that people are good. We have, what's the greatest gift we've been given? I'm going to argue that the greatest gift that God gives us is free will. Now, we have infinite free will, which means we have the capacity to screw up infinitely. Okay, we can keep getting it wrong. But, God loves us enough to give us that option and to let us learn. And hopefully we do. And that's what that first week of the spiritual exercises is about. It's about, who am I? What is my history that has brought me here? What are the things I have the capacity to do? What are the things I don't have the capacity to do? What are the mistakes I keep going back to again and again and again and again? Where does what Ignatius is going to call the dark spirit, where does it have a grasp on me? Because if you're going to be free from something, you better know what it is that has power over you, right? So I think that's where that talk about I'm a sinner, I think that's where that comes from. I think the other thing that we see in this guy is, I think he has a very profound sense of dependence on God, that He has a lot of resources. He has a lot of influences at his disposal. He has had for a while. But I think he's aware that he is, you know, he has to do what he can and then be indifferent to the outcomes, because ultimately that's how things work too. And that's going to come out of this Jesuit idea of indifference. Not an indifference of not an apathetic sort of indifference, but an indifference to, am I rich or am I poor? Am I sick all the time or am I healthy? Okay, we can know on all these kind of scales what it is we want, but again, the question for a Jesuit is, and that gets worked out in the exercises, is which of those things draws me closer to God? What kind of state of life is best for me? That's the one that God wants. Okay, so in Jesuit formation, like I said, Ignatius was a pretty wild guy. All right, it took a while to get the saint label on that one, and that's a whole other talk. But part of the guy's thing is for about 10 years between when he gets injured and when he starts the Jesuits with a bunch of his buddies, he wanders around Europe as a pilgrim, okay? And he wants, you know, he's from a pretty well-to-do family, but they don't have a lot of resources. And he wants to be radically, totally, completely dependent on God for everything. Okay, that's how he perceives that he can be drawn closer, is to get God to draw him closer. Okay, so he wanders around, and any place he goes, he begs from people. That's how he makes his living. That's how he pays for his education and so on. Okay, and in doing so, he discovered that when he was able to do that, when he was able to trust, you know, let go of the trapeze, and trust that God would catch him, God did catch him. And he wanted every Jesuit to have that experience. Okay? So even in our constitutions and in our formation, even today, Jesuits do this pilgrimage experience. Young Jesuits, novices, will go and do this pilgrimage where you are very dependent on God. I did a kind of crazy experiment for that. When I ended up going to Ireland and living in Northern Ireland for a while, and this is prior to the Good Friday Accords, so you know it was an interesting time and an interesting place. But one of my novitiate classmates, I remember watching Chris go out the door of the novitiate, and he had a bus ticket to Seattle. The novitiate was in Portland, so he'd be like from here to Canberra. And so I remember him walk out the door, and he had a bus ticket in his hand, and he had $20 in his pocket and 2.5 months on the calendar. And I remember thinking, I'm never going to see him alive again. Now, that has nothing to do with the bus ticket or the $20. It had everything to do with, if you knew this guy, he is a wonderful person. But the term tightly wrapped only begins to scratch the surface of his control needs, okay? And I remember thinking, he's going to worry himself to death, okay? And what he'd been missioned to do was, he'd been missioned to visit, we had a lot of Native American missions in that part of the U.S., and he was supposed to hitchhike, and wherever he went, he was supposed to kind of depend on the people that were there. And that's what he did. So 2.5 months later, Jack flies in from Northern Ireland, and we all get together, and he is glowing. This guy is like, you know, a completely different person. And wherever he went, people took care of him. And people, like, you know, slid him a little money. And these are people with nothing, you know, on some of these reservations. And like one time, he kept going east, and somebody said, hey, I heard you need a ride to the next res. And he's like, yeah, it's 800 miles. And they're like, yeah, come on, jump in, let's go. You know, and people took care of him. And he was intimately aware that God was working through that and taking care of him. I think this guy has that sense as well, that while he has all of these resources at his disposal, while he can influence a lot of things, at the end of the day, he's dependent on God. That he has that sense that anything he does, well, he may work for it, but the outcome is not his doing. Okay? A, I think that's good leadership. I think that's what good leaders do, is, you know, if you're a leader, your success isn't your own. It's the people that work for you. And B, I think he has a very good sense that, you know, it's the Holy Spirit working through him that's doing that. And I think he has that sense of dependency. So I think that's a second thing I would say. Thirdly, like I said, the exercises, the spiritual exercises, when you listen to him talk, and again, you know, I was raised by wolves or Jesuits, as the case may be, and so for the last 25 years of my life, you know, for the last 27, I've been around Jesuits. For the last 25, I've been living in this society. So there are all these things that I kind of take for granted about the way we think, the way we do things, that you may not. The exercises are an incredibly powerful, incredibly individual experience. Every Jesuit is going to make these exercises twice in their life, at least twice. And like I said, in their full form, 30 days, silence, you're talking with your director, maybe once a day for 45 minutes or so. You're praying for about 4 or 5 hours a day. It's pretty intense. Now, the first time I did this, I was a novice, right? And I'm like, you know, I'm doing this, and I'd been in the Jesuits for like 2 months, and I was thoroughly convinced that I had broken the spiritual exercises, because I didn't know what was supposed to be happening, but whatever it was, I was certain that that's what it wasn't happening, okay? But that's the thing. God works with us where we are, not where we would like to be. So God works with us where we are at that moment. The second time I made the exercises was here. I made the exercises out at the Jesuit retreat house at Seven Hill, which I have to say, if you're going to spend 30 days in silence, I highly recommend a winery. But I digress. So the next time I made it, I was with a group of Jesuits from around the world, and there were 13 of us from 8 different countries. And we, at the end of things, you know, and we'd see each other, and we took our meals in silence, and we had a couple of break days where we could talk and so on. At the end of the retreat, we gathered together and sat down and talked about, you know, what was the fruit of the retreat? What had God been kind of doing for us during that time? If you had been present at that conversation, I think you would have said, are you sure you guys all did the same thing? Because, you know, the results are so different. Well, you had 13 individuals in 13 different places with God. And so God, how God worked with us was radically different. And that's part of the exercise, is God works with us where we are, not where we want to be. I think that leads back to that I'm a sinner stuff too, that dependence on God for everything. The exercises are pretty transformative. It's a series of prayers and meditations and conversations, and I could tell you everything about it, or I could give you a copy of it. And this is a classic. This is a classic Jesuit mistake right here. So you like go through the entrance process, you get admitted to the Jesuits, and you're like, I'm going to get ahead of the game. I'm going to go out, I'm going to get a copy of the spiritual exercises. So you do that, and then you start reading through, and you're like, what is this? This is crazy, because it's not that kind of a book. It's not a book you read. It's a series of prayers you pray and pray through, and it's only kind of in the repetition of it that it starts to make sense. So the exercises are absolutely one of the hallmarks that we're hearing him talk about. When he's talking about God working with individuals, when he's talking about how and where do we find God, which leads me into my next point. What's the point of this? Why bother doing 30 days in silence, you know, by yourself and so on? more or less by yourself, having a conversation with God. The point of the exercises is to lead us to election of some sort, to lead us to choice. Ignatius has this huge section of the exercises devoted to what he calls the discernment of spirits. He says that there are always kind of two spirits working on us, that there's the spirit of light that's from God, and then there's a spirit of darkness that, well, I'll let you guess where that's from. And, you know, one of those is trying to get to lead us closer to God, and it's trying to get us to pay attention to what Abraham Lincoln called the better angels of our nature. Okay? And, again, we are always free to ignore or to continue, continue making the same mistakes. And part of the thing about discernment of spirits is that not everything that seems to be a good thing is a good thing. All right? Sometimes the dark spirit works that way too. But the exercises, if they're about anything, they're about listening. They're about listening to where I'm being called and reaching out and grabbing a hold of that call and making some kind of decision. Now, I've directed people on the exercises before. And, you know, part of the thing is just, whoa, slow down. You know, let's discern this a little bit. Where you can get somebody in there like really fired up and they're like, I have to sell everything and go and work with Mother Teresa's sisters in, you know, Calcutta or whoa. Maybe you do. Maybe that is the best thing. But you know, what about something else that also, you know, if there's a competing thing in there, you know, maybe what God really is calling you to is to have a career and, you know, and all. And so it's about, again, teasing out what's good, what's better. And how do you know the difference? Well, again, I think we hear him talking about this stuff about good and better. You know, when you look at what he's saying, I think a lot of it goes back to this stuff around the first principle and foundation, that the world is a good place, that we are all, every single one of us, called to sainthood, to sanctity. Now, at this point in my life, I've read enough about Jesuit saints that A, I know I'll never be one, and B, I'm glad I've never had to live with one, because most of them sound like real pains. But I don't think that's the kind of sanctity that we're all called to. I think we're all called to an everyday sanctity, and that's what I have believed for years, and that's what I hear this guy saying now, is, are you paying attention to the God who's right in front of you? Are you following the God who is immediately available? Not the big, I can't be Mother Teresa. It's not here. It's not in this person. I'm called, but I'm not called to be here. I'm called to be a saint in a different way and to fumble along trying to get there. Okay? So I think those are the kind of things, that's the kind of sanctity that we're called to. And it's about knowing where God is in that stuff. Well, how do we do that? This discernment of spirit stuff is really important. It's really important. It's hard to get right, but it's important. And I think the key to it is sort of that repetition. It's about going back every day and saying, where was God in today? As boring and mundane or as horrible as today was. And look, I don't care who you are. You're going to have miserable, horrible days. And some people in this room have probably had even worse days than I've had. And I've had some bad days. You know, sorry, religious life is not a winning lottery ticket to, you know, happiness every single day. There's some bad stuff in there. Last time I checked, the gospel doesn't promise us that it's going to be all, you know, laughs. But to find God even in that, or if you can't find God in that, to at least look for him. And if you can't find him, thump him on the chest a little bit and say, where were you today? Where were you? Because I can't see you today. I couldn't see you in today. If we can do that, if we can start paying attention to what I think of as kind of a tidal ebb and flow, because, you know, we have, most of us have had that experience of, you know, man, God's right here, right now. God's easy today, easy to find God today. We got to pay attention to that. And then, you know, something goes on and it's like, I don't know where God's been for weeks, months, you know. Okay, well, if we can kind of track that, the tide going in and out, then the pattern starts to become easier to see. And our awareness of who and what God is speaking to us through becomes easier to respond to. And that's where discernment becomes possible. That's where we can listen with the ear inside the chest and know where it is we're being drawn, where it is we're being called. Sometimes the things that we're being called to are not things that we sort of want, but they're the things that we really know we need to do. How do we know that? Ignatius is going to say we have a sense of peace about it. That even when I'm presented with something I don't necessarily want to do or choose, it's like, yep, that's what I need to do and I know it. And in finding that peace, that'll also give us the ability, the knowledge that that's where God is in choosing that difficult path. So I think that's important. All right. Last point. Okay, where does all this lead us to? You have to have not been paying attention. If the question is, where is Francis's treasure? If that's the question, then is there anybody who would doubt that his treasure is the poor? I mean, find a day so far during his papacy when he hasn't talked about, been with, you know, said, this is where we need to be. I think that's pretty obvious. Why? Why is he so concerned with the have-nots? And I don't think he's talking just about economic have-nots. Certainly, that is a factor, okay? But I don't just think he's talking about that. I don't think socioeconomic success corresponds directly to other forms of poverty. I know that one of the poorest kids I ever taught, his parents were some of the richest doctors in town, not on this continent, but and I just know that because of interactions in class and having heard this kid, I'll never forget this. This kid said, you know, my parents and I, he was year 12, and he's like, my parents and I fight, and all I want to do is have a conversation with them. And every time the conversations get heavy and serious, they hand me a credit card and say, go shopping. And I was like, whoa, you have a poverty I am not sure I can address, you know? So poverty isn't just economic, and who the poor are is not just people in barrios and slums and wherever, okay? But clearly, his heart, and that is where his treasure is. Look at the people that he's responded to so far. He's responded to people who are outcasts, who have no voice, who are powerless and cast out of inner circles. And he's saying those are the ones we have to go to. Why is he saying that? What about his Jesuit background or training or experience might be telling him that? Well, again, that's going to go back to St. Ignatius. Ignatius is the one who puts a lot of this stuff in motion for Jesuits. And Ignatius had this real thing about the poor, that Jesuits should be there. Why? Why? Well, let's strip it back to primary sources. Who does Jesus hang out with in the gospel? Tax collectors, sinners, you know, all the people. He hangs out with the rich and the famous and the powerful too. But, you know, he's usually tweaking them about, how come you're not hanging out with these other people? Because they're pretty cool too. And the people he chooses to be amongst is the powerless and the downtrodden and the excluded and what's his message there? God is with you. God is with you. In his culture, a lot of those people would have been being told, you don't have access to God. You can't afford to go to the temple. You collaborate with the Romans. There would have been a lot of messages to them that they were beyond the pale, that they could not have access to God. And that, if nothing else, is Jesus' message. So if that's where Jesus hung out, that this is Ignatius's logic. If Jesus hung out with these people and found God there, I wonder where I should go. Oh, I think I'll go and hang out with them. So he did. Okay? And again, well, today, yes, we do have schools and ministries in the Jesuits that cater to leadership classes. We absolutely have those. We also have people in some of the poorest corners and working with some of the poorest groups of people everywhere. Why? Because that's where St. Ignatius said you can find Jesus. And I think if this guy is interested in anything, it is about finding Jesus. All right. So that's all great. I will wrap up here. I think all of this leads us back around to this question of where is my treasure? I think that gives us some clues about where Pope Francis's treasure is. I think his ultimate thing, though, is he wants us to discover our treasure. And he knows where he's found it. He's found it amongst the poor. And so I think that's why he's on that. But his question to us is, where is your treasure? Where do you need to be looking? And this is me, this is you, this is everybody. This is you know, non-believers. This is everybody. Where is your treasure? He wants, and I think expects, or he desires that everybody would be able to go and search for that and look. And if we can find the courage to do that, I don't think it matters if we're successful or not by our